Welcome to Designed for More, brought to you by Common Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. Join Dr. Timothy Jennings, a renowned expert in psychiatry, neuroscience, and spiritual well-being, as he explores the connections between mind, body, spirit, and relationships.
Hello, and welcome to Designed for More, sponsored by Common Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. I'm Dr. Tim Jennings, joined today by Annalisa Moreno, one of our therapists, and James Johnson, our chief of chaplains here at the clinic. And today our topic is understanding God's anger. I received the question that was sent in that reads, there are many verses in the Bible that says God was angry or he became angry, and they list several here. These are just a few examples. What does it mean for God to be angry? How do we understand God's anger?
Well, one of the great things about how God has made us is we are made in his image. We're his image bearers. And in one way that we do that is in our emotions. You know, we have numerous examples, as the questioner pointed out, of God being angry. I mean, when Jesus was angry, he flipped the tables in the temple and ran the money changers out because they were doing something that angered him. And one of the things that I think we really mess up in our culture in the United States is that we celebrate some emotions and we demonize others. And anger is one of those ones that is. I mean, even, you know, whenever we see examples of people getting angry in movies and television shows, they usually do something destructive. They do something damaging.
You mean like flip tables?
Yeah. But like the goal was not to damage something or hurt people. The emotions that we feel give us information. They tell us something about what we're experiencing in our lives. And the emotion of anger tells us something unjust is going on, something that is in conflict with what our beliefs of right and wrong are. In particular, with the situation of Jesus and the money changers, it was unjust what they were doing in, you know, basically committing fraud to extort the people that they had to exchange their Roman currency for temple currency. And doing so, if you had traveled from somewhere outside of the local area, you couldn't bring your own animals, so you would have to use temple currency to buy your animals for sacrifice. And these people were making tons of money, and it was keeping the people, a lot of them, from being able to worship and encounter God because they couldn't afford it.
Worse, it was representing God as being exploitive, manipulative, and an extortionist.
Right.
They were the priests representing. So it wasn't just that we're keeping
right.
It was the misrepresentation of God that was going on at the temple.
And both of those are unjust, yeah.
Yes, correct. But so are you saying that Jesus' anger that he had there is like our anger? That's what I hear you saying.
I mean, as a human being, he felt emotions.
I wouldn't describe Jesus' anger the way I would describe human anger. Human anger is impulsive. It's ego-driven. Jesus' anger is righteous, and it's proportionate to the situation.
So let's keep going with the question. I like where you're going.
Yeah.
Because let's thoughtfully reflect. You're not wrong at pointing out that example. I'm glad you brought it up. It's very helpful for us to maybe differentiate. Because the question about God's anger, that's God in human flesh. There's a situation where he has these strong emotions, anger. In human anger, like you also mentioned movies and angry. When humans get angered, does it often lead to loss of control? Emotion, their emotions take over.
Yes.
Are you saying that Jesus lost control of himself when he got angry?
No. But I'm saying that
So his actions were anger-based?
I think they were anger-fueled. The goal of our emotions is to motivate us towards doing something or recognizing something. And when
think that's fruit.
Okay.
No, really. What's the last fruit of the Holy Spirit?
It's self-control.
And when we get angry, do we lose self-control?
Not if our emotions are regulated. If we can balance our feelings with reality of the situation, it can lead us to truth. If I see in my local community that there is a section of the community that is not receiving the right things that everybody else is receiving from the town's, you know, productivity, and I feel like that's unjust. Well, if I was apathetic and I did not have that emotion of anger, I'd just let it go. It wouldn't bother me. Like, whatever, it doesn't matter. It's not affecting me. The injustices in the temple, wasn't going to keep Jesus from interacting with God.
So I'm still trying to dissect and differentiate human anger from God's anger. And the reason I'm pressing this is because I heard you equating Jesus as an example of human anger. I guess we have emotions like he has emotions, you went straight there.
I think it's an example of anger perfectly balanced without, like she said, the selfish ego-driven that causes me to lose control and balance with reality. Help me out with your perspective.
I'm asking questions. I don't want to just declare things. I'm trying to process this.
Okay.
Let's take this story and bring it into modern times. A Bible teacher, Jesus, rabbi, Bible teacher, who comes into your church one Saturday or Sunday and sees maybe some things that are not representative of God as they should be, throws over the pulpit, the communion table in the front, and handles it inside, and all of the church leaders flee. In your church, what do you think would happen with the children that were down front when that happened? If that happened today and somebody did that, would you expect the children to feel safe and stay by?
No, not at all.
But if you read the Bible account when Jesus did this, the children stayed by. So how is it that Jesus' anger was displayed in such a way that only the sinful adults who were exploiting ran, but the innocent children were not frightened?
That's a good question.
That's in the account.
Yeah, I'm with you.
So this is, you know, going past just the potential expression of anger to the other elements of the story and looking at the evidence of the impact and going, something unusual is going on here.
Mm-hmm.
Is it? And to me, I'm not suggesting at all that you are wrong that Jesus is angry there. I'm suggesting that we might make an error by suggesting a complete merging with human anger.
Okay.
That he was angry there, I think so. Mm-hmm. But it was something different about that kind of anger that actually made the innocents feel safe. The children didn't flee.
Right.
But I suspect in our churches today, it would be very difficult for even you, if you saw something totally inappropriate going on in church, to disrupt the service, throw over the tables, drive out the wicked leaders in such a way that the children did not get frightened and came to you.
Mm-hmm.
You see where I'm going with this? Something else is going on there.
Yep.
And I think God's anger is going to be like that.
Okay.
That the righteous, innocent, pure of heart are drawn to those displays.
Sure.
Whereas the wicked are driven from those displays.
Mm-hmm.
Is this possible?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What would be the elements? What would that look like?
Really, I'm thinking at the core, there's love, because what we defend is what we care about. So his anger in flipping up the table, who's he defending in that moment?
So they're perceiving he is loving them.
That's their place of worship.
Okay. All right. I like where you're going with that. And we want to tie this back in now to the questioner.
Mm-hmm.
Old Testament times, God's getting angry, thundering, threatening words. Many, and the adults are frequently running. And how do we understand that? Is it different than what we see Jesus doing in the temple, or is it the same dynamic, different situation, but the same process?
Sure. It's the same heart, same idea.
Yeah. So any thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, something that's, you know, you're mentioning that's important is that when people trust God and are in harmony with him, his presence is delightful. I mean, all throughout scripture, we see people delighting in the presence of God when they're at one with him, in harmony with him. But people who are not are terrified of him. They want away from him. And it's the same thing with the recognition of this situation of anger. Like you said, the children were safe because they trusted him.
So terrified of him when they're not in harmony with him.
Mm-hmm.
And that terror comes from a terrible God?
No, it's fear and distrust of God's
creator. Right. So it's their perceptions of God.
Exactly.
Oh, so many things come to my mind as you say that.
I mean, it's why Peter in the beginning, at his first encounter with Jesus, he said, Lord, he knew who Jesus was. He said, get away from me, Lord, I'm a sinful man. He was terrified of him, wanted away from him. But at the end, he knew that he was not only Lord, he was also love. And so he wanted to reconcile his relationship and ran towards him.
When do you think Jacob actually came to know God in truth?
Mm.
Before or after his name was changed? I mean, before or when his name was changed?
When, yeah.
So how would Jacob, who didn't really know God yet, see God up until the time he actually came to that point and had his name changed? How would he see him as a terrible God, a terrifying God? Does that mean that God is that way?
No.
It means that Jacob doesn't actually perceive him right yet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, and what kind of character did Jacob have that ultimately was changed that night he wrestled?
Oh, yeah. He was a deceiver.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, and so do we tend to see people with attributes of ourselves?
Mm-hmm.
If we're cheats and liars, do we see it and anticipate other people cheating and lying?
Sure.
Projected
yeah.
on.
And then the wicked, when Christ returns in Revelation, the lost beg for the mountains to fall on them.
Mm-hmm.
It's because it's terrifying, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're scared. Do you think Jesus is two-faced? In other words, the righteous, when he comes, he's smiling with love, but with the wicked, he's looking mean and angry. Or do you think he has the same righteous face?
Mm-hmm. It's the same.
Same right.
Yesterday, same forever.
But the perception,
mm-hmm.
is that what's happening in the temple then?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that this is where I wanted to go. I think with our hearts being as not as pure as Jesus,
sure.
it's hard for us, I think, to have that same righteous anger.
Oh, absolutely.
That comes across with a purity of love for the innocent and for the people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Our anger's often, I think, for ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Is that fair?
Yeah, fair. Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay. So can we break down, is there any, I've thought about this, I want to see if you have thoughts about this, on any way to differentiate, you know, we've differentiated maybe in impact on people,
mm-hmm.
godly anger, they the righteous will experience it differently than mm-hmm. ungodly anger, but is there a different underlying motivation? I think you were getting to that point between godly anger and human anger.
Human anger, asking yourself, is it rooted in fear?
And? Selfishness, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And godly anger is motivated by mm-hmm. love and what's best for people. And so godly anger would be anger at sinners or anger at sin?
Sin. Yeah.
And the metaphor I like would be doctors
mm-hmm.
have righteous anger against measles and smallpox and cancer. And doctors hate cancer so bad, they will make weapons of war, mm-hmm. radiation knives, mm-hmm. and chemical weapons, chemotherapy,
right.
to attack and destroy mm-hmm. those cancer cells.
The sin.
Okay? Because they hate the cancer patient?
No.
Because they want to save the cancer patient from it.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Okay, and so God's anger and wrath, so to speak, his rage is not against the sinner.
Mm-hmm.
It's against the sin, the fear, the distrust, the guilt, the shame, the selfishness, the maliciousness, the bitterness, all the things that sin brings. He hates, he wants to free us from that, doesn't he?
Mm-hmm.
Use the term rage. How does that differ from wrath?
The human wrath and rage would be very similar. My view of rage is the movement of the energy toward the action, the rage against the cancer makes you, take the knife and cut out the tumor mm-hmm. or take the radiation knife to burn out the cancer. Mm-hmm. And so God's rage is manifested and it's described this way as a burning fire. Mm-hmm. But if you read in all through the scripture,
yeah.
it's the burning fire of love
mm-hmm.
and the burning fire of truth. So truth and love burns out from God to mm-hmm. burn out lies, to burn out fear, to burn out selfishness. Okay, with what? With love and truth.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you can't actually burn that stuff out of the heart with combustion.
That's right.
With threats, with intimidation, you can't get rid of it. It's so it's metaphorical
mm-hmm.
in the same way you don't actually see the radiation from the radiation knife,
mm-hmm.
and the knife actually isn't a knife, it's particles, radiation particles being used in a like a gun to go in and cut.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? Yeah. But you can't see that with your eye either.
No.
So yeah, so that's the metaphor I use as the metaphor of a doctor being angry, but not at the sick patient. But what and then if you follow that through with the sin problem, if a doctor who is very angry, and maybe the doctor is the father and they have a sick son who has gotten cancer because of maybe they have been smoking, and the doctor happens to be an oncologist and has still a treatment to help save their son, and the son refuses, won't take the chemo, won't participate in any treatment,
Yeah. Does
that make the father angry?
Yes.
It does. Is he only angry at the cancer now?
No.
Does he hate the boy?
No.
No. So where's that anger focused? What's that anger about?
It's his failure to get in line with the remedy.
Yeah. So, I mean, he's angry because he could save this child he loves if the child would let him.
Right.
Yeah.
His anger is because the choice is interfering with what's right and good. He's not angry at the child. He's angry at the choice of the child.
Yeah.
And he wants to save the child. Yeah. Isn't that true?
Yes.
Yeah. You see that applying to sin and sinners?
Yes.
Do you see that in Old Testament? Any stories that come to mind where you see God's frustration and anger being expressed like this?
Oh, sure. I mean, in numerous cities and people groups were destroyed after all of the interventions God tried, and they refused to get in line with it.
So I'm going to read to you out of I think it's from the Remedy, Hebrews chapter 3, verses 16 and 19. Okay, and this is in Hebrews, whoever wrote Hebrews, I think it was Paul, it doesn't actually say, but the writer of Hebrews is reflecting on the children of Israel leaving Egypt, wandering in the wilderness, dying in the wilderness, and not going into the promised land. Mm-hmm. And they're making an application not to be like that now. And this says, who were they who heard the message of healing truth, but instead rebelled and preferred lies? Were they not all those whom Moses led out of Egypt? And with what was God angry for 40 years? Why was God angry for 40 years? This is the question. Was it not with having to watch his children persistently reject his healing ways and slowly die and fall in the desert? That's why he's angry.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how would it frustrate you and be angry that you're constantly offering healing and salvation? They're constantly refusing and rejecting.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And whom did God tell that they could never get well and find rest as long as they rebelled against the only remedy, if not those who died in the desert? So we see that they were not able to get well and enter into God's rest because they didn't trust him or accept the truth he revealed. It's very straightforward. God is constantly offering health, salvation, healing, redemption.
Yeah.
And when we refuse it, he gets angry. His anger is not the cause of our pain, suffering, and demise in the desert or anywhere else. His anger is because of our pain, suffering, and demise, because we keep him excluded from healing and saving us.
Right.
Is this fair to say? Would you say? Is that how it's often presented, God's anger? How has it been presented to you?
Anger, for starters, wasn't for me growing up. I didn't learn about God's anger at first. I learned about anger through my parents. And if you're seeing anger that is impulsive or unsafe, then when you start learning about God's anger, you automatically attribute those characteristics of anger, what anger looks like, from your earthly father to your heavenly father. So you've got a very distorted perception of God's anger. So growing up in church, at Bible study, God's anger was terrifying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very much so. Same thing for me, even though I did grow up in church, that God was presented as vengeful, wrathful, that he wants to hurt the people rather than being angry at the decisions the people are making to reject him and his healing.
So then what do you say to those who say, okay, then what about Sodom?
Mm-hmm.
What about the flood? What about the plagues of Egypt? What about the 185,000 Assyrians? What about Korah, Dathan, and Abiram?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a recognition that the at a certain point, in order to save other things, you have to get rid of what's absolutely, you know, chosen to be beyond saving, like a doctor who amputates a gangrenous limb, that infection has spread so pervasively through the arm, it can't be saved because it's gone too far.
I absolutely love that that analogy.
Mm-hmm.
So let's tighten it up with the biblical evidence,
right. Mm-hmm.
Because some people may go, that's beautiful, but that's you know, how does, you know, killing the sodomites save, you know, how does that save the body? Those people, you follow what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Okay. So let's tighten it up.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where, when you look at these isolated events that I pulled out, mm-hmm. many people get confused because they try to look at them in isolation.
Mm-hmm.
All these actions, I believe God took. But if you want to understand really what's happening, you have to understand the landscape of where we are mm-hmm. in the biblical narrative. As soon as Adam and Eve sinned in Eden, could any human being be eternally saved from sin without Jesus Christ?
No.
And so immediately, before he even tosses them out of the garden, mm-hmm. in Genesis 3:15, he tells them the seed of the woman is coming to crush the serpent's head
mm-hmm.
and he will bruise his heel.
Right.
Messiah is promised right there. They're not even out of Eden yet. They're sinners, but salvation, hope, redemption is promised. Mm-hmm. Jesus is coming. Yes or no?
Yes.
The entire Old Testament narrative is the narrative of fulfilling that promise.
Mm-hmm.
That's why the Bible focuses where it focuses. That's why we don't focus on people in China or South America or more Sudan or mm-hmm. Ethiopia, even though Ethiopia is mentioned, some of these places are mentioned.
Right.
It's because the Jesus wasn't coming through those branches of the human family. And you notice after the flood, which is worldwide, because mm-hmm. we didn't know which branch was going to have it, immediately God promises Abraham's kids. But we're not focusing on Ishmael's kids. We're focusing on Isaac's. But we're not focusing on Esau's kids. We're focusing on Jacob's. You notice the narrative keeps narrowing. And it still keeps narrowing after that because it's not through all 12. It's through Judah.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually we're down to Judah and Levi by the time Jesus comes.
Right.
10 get assimilated into the north.
Mm-hmm.
Gone, assimilated, okay? And so why? Because the whole narrative is that fulfillment of that promise. And so the whole Old Testament narrative is the conflict between Satan trying to obstruct and prevent Jesus from coming and God intervening to bring Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
That's the first point to understand, in my view.
Right.
Second point is you have to disconnect the merged falsehood of the deaths that people have experienced thus far in human history mm-hmm. with the wages of sin, death, which doesn't come until after the judgment.
Right.
Yeah.
Everybody who's died, the Bible describes as a sleep death, mm-hmm. and they rise in one of two resurrections, resurrection of life or resurrection of damnation. Mm-hmm. So the people who die in human history right now is not the death that is the ultimate wages of sin.
Right.
In fact, Jesus said, those who believe in him, even though they die, they will never die. Mm-hmm. He's talking, even though they might sleep in the grave, they're not going to die from sin.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And so it's important because the wages of sin, what Adam and Eve did, is an action that without remedy results in the eternal death,
mm-hmm.
not this temporary death that there's a resurrection from. So all the people that died, whether it's died of old age, whether it's died in battle, whether it's died with fire raining down in the city, or a flood,
mm-hmm.
they all died the same quality death, which is the first death sleep experience, and they will all raise in one of two resurrections. It's important to differentiate that mm-hmm. so we don't falsely conclude God is punishing sin. This is where you said every one of these actions in the Old Testament are therapeutic interventions by God to keep open avenue for Messiah.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, how do you get that? We've already established without Jesus, no human can be saved.
Mm-hmm.
How can Satan prevent it? If he gets every human heart in the world to harden and won't work with God, will God have Jesus born to a woman like Jezebel who would offer baby Jesus to sacrifice to Molech? He's not going to do that, is he?
No.
No. So he has to have a righteous, willing woman.
Mm-hmm.
And so if he gets all the people to harden their heart permanently, then he shuts down the plan of salvation. And you say, well, that's really a whole world of people. That's not going to happen. At the time of the flood, Genesis 6, how many righteous people, as the Bible say, were on the earth? One in his family.
every other person is not willing to work with God. And so what do you see? The flood doesn't come as punishment for sin. It shows, if you understand context and landscape, what a patient, merciful, gracious, loving God, that he waits and he waits and he waits and he preaches for 120 years. And only when there's one family on the whole planet that's willing to work with him does he act, not to punish sin. This is just putting him in the grave for sleep to keep open an avenue for Messiah, because about Jesus, every human being's lost.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, well, Sodom and Gomorrah in the cities. Without the final, I think there was like five cities. Was it Sodom and Gomorrah and five, or Sodom and Gomorrah and three?
Three, yeah.
Yeah, so five cities in total,
mm-hmm.
Okay? Without those five cities, 10 of the tribes don't make it through,
mm-hmm.
from the pagan influences around them.
That's right.
My view is that the gangrene element, mm-hmm. that he excised that necrotic area, and he tells the story of Abraham to let us know why. There weren't even in these cities 10 righteous people. There weren't 10. Lot couldn't even get his entire family to leave. Lot is taken out by the hand by the angels. Two daughters go with him. Wife can't detach, turns back. She'd prefer to die with the city, which she does. And the daughters are so barely willing to follow that as soon as they're out of the city, they get dad drunk, have incest with him, and have children by dad, the Ammonites and the Moabites, that end up persecuting the Israelites.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is not the story.
That's right, yeah.
So what does it tell us? That yes, without the influence of those cities, only two tribes barely make it through. Mm-hmm. My view is if he didn't excise those necrotic lesions without anybody willing to work, mm-hmm. that influence would have been enough to subsume the rest of Israel. So this again was therapeutic activity.
Mm-hmm.
And you see the same dynamic happening through history. So that's my view. The plagues of Egypt, what are they? They're actually, every plague was an attack against the gods of Egypt,
mm-hmm.
not the people.
People.
For the purpose of enlightening the people that what they're worshiping is not real, mm-hmm. to call them back to worship Yahweh. This is not just for the Hebrews, it was for the Egyptians. Mm-hmm. And if you read the text, a mixed multitude of many Egyptians went out and gave their heart to Yahweh and began worshiping Yahweh.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that true?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So this was not an attack against the people. And this is what we see going. So is God angry? Yes, he's angry at everything that injures that which he loves.
Mm-hmm.
And he's angry when those he loves refuses to let him heal.
That's right.
But he's not the source of pain, suffering, and death.
Mm-hmm.
And that's quite different than our anger. Mm-hmm. Our anger is when we don't get our own way. Mm-hmm. When our own ideas are challenged. When our projects or pursuits are interfered with, when our plans don't come to fruition, when we don't get the praise that we think we deserve. I mean, this, and isn't it, that's what you said earlier, self-centered anger, mm-hmm. right?
Ego-driven. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So other thoughts about where people may struggle with Bible stories. We talked about those because I many of those examples I wanted to go through because I think people may reference those as evidence of God's anger. But it's really evidences of his grace, mercy, love, and therapeutic interventions, in my view.
Well, one of the ones we've talked about before, but I think is really key, because it seems on the surface, at least how I always had it presented to me, it seems unloving. Adam and Eve break trust with God. They get kicked out of the garden. God puts heavenly beings to keep them from getting back in. And it actually says, so they won't get to the tree of life and live forever. God is preventing them from life. And it was, you know, I always kind of saw like, man, that's really mean and cruel of God. That,
how do you see it now?
Right, yeah.
Tell me how you see it now.
Well now, I mean, if they could live forever, they would live forever in this sinful brokenness, that they would never be able to experience the remedy because, you know, they would not be able to die and then later be resurrected by Messiah.
So this question comes up a lot. Let's we're not declared the absolute answer.
Right.
We have to reason through it.
Mm-hmm.
Did the tree of life, did the tree of life actually be the originator of life, or does life still originate in God?
Yeah.
So the tree of life provided something. For instance, realize it's not on earth right now, but in order for us to live, do we have to eat stuff from trees,
mm-hmm.
and plants?
Yes.
In other words, we have to eat food,
mm-hmm.
which provides us some type of sustaining energy.
That's right.
Does that mean life comes from those plants? No, life still comes from God, but it sustains us in some way. Is the tree of life providing something more than what our current plants provide. I think it does, yes. But life does not actually come from them. My view is that the tree of life provided some type of nutrition or energy, whatever you want to call it, nutrition and energy are very similar, that prevents aging.
Mm-hmm.
It prevents the decay of your genome, when your cells replicate, you lose little bits of your telomeres. It prevents all of that. I think that the tree of life prevents aging. But would the tree of life, if they had access to it, prevented Cain from bashing Abel's head in? Would it prevent beheading? Would it prevent a nuclear weapon from being developed and dropped on Hiroshima?
No.
And if somebody had ate the tree of life and had been in Hiroshima, would the nuclear, you know, vaporization not affect their body? Or would their body still been vaporized?
Yes.
Okay, so this tree of life, this is important for you to realize, the tree of life would not actually prevent death. It does not give immortality.
Right.
What does it do? It prevents aging.
Mm-hmm.
They won't die naturally. Remember he said that you will die and you will die. You're going to age, decay, and die.
Mm-hmm.
But if you get to the tree of life, you won't age, decay, and die.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what's the problem with that? If he allows that in a world in which Cain bashes Abel's head in which people like Hitler and Stalin and despots arise, if the tree of life actually exists on this planet, or the metaphorical fountain of youth,
mm-hmm.
if such a thing existed, does it stop death from happening?
Not at all.
It just stops disease and decay.
Right.
So if you had an illness, it would fix it. Genetic, I think it does something to genetic perfection, basically. Does that make sense?
Yes.
But it wouldn't stop the death from these other causes.
Mm-hmm.
So will the tree of life cause love, trust, self-sacrifice, pure heart, Christ-like behavior? Yes, no.
No.
So in a world in which hearts are unconverted, self-centered, exploitive, like Adolf Hitler, who would control the tree of life? The kind, the self-sacrifice, the patient, the ones who won't pick up an arm, the ones who turn the other cheek, or the evil?
Yeah, the evil.
And if they don't age, then what happens? What happens to this planet if the wicked have the access and they don't age and they don't die out? If Stalin doesn't die out? Do you understand why? This is my view as to why he barred it. Not because he was being mean.
Mm-hmm.
This was incredible love and mercy.
Exactly.
To limit the horrors of sin.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
Run rampant.
Exactly. Yeah, this is my view.
Mm-hmm.
So the question still is I think it ties into God's anger. Yeah. Somebody may look at that. He's mad at him, won't let him have the good stuff anymore. Oh, he's mad at them and he cursed the ground.
Yeah.
Is that an evidence of God's anger? Or was God, when he said, cursed is the ground for your sake, you will sweat from your brow, you will toil the earth and sweat from your brow, and so forth and so on. Was this an infliction from God? Or is this a description from God?
Mm-hmm.
What was he saying? When you were in harmony with me, you had total authority over planet Earth. You were the governor of Earth under my authority. I have delegated you the powers over this planet. You don't have those now. They've been usurped. You've handed them over.
That's right.
An enemy has those. Now the earth is going to do something it didn't actually do because the enemy, remember Jesus used the metaphor of the wheat and the tares? Mm-hmm. Who sowed those? An enemy has done this.
That's right.
In my view, before Adam's fall, in the entire planet, there was not one thorn or thistle.
Mm-hmm.
There were no poisonous plants or noxious herbs. There was no poison ivy. There were no poison mushrooms. There were nothing that was harmful on this planet.
Mm-hmm.
All of that is through genetic manipulation and amalgamations and corruptions and decay and mutations. This is my view.
Yeah.
I don't think there were any diseases or pestilences.
Right.
Yeah.
You agree?
For sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so this the earth now, it becomes harder to bring forth the bounty of the earth. So the cursed is the earth because of you.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, because of what you've done. It's going to be harder now.
That's right.
So I don't think God
is angry and inflicting, I think God is describing the natural results. How about Eve? Your desire will be for your husband, and he will rule over you. Is God inflicting a punishment because he's mad? Oh, woman, you're the worst of sin. Or is she describing? Is he prescribing a prescription? Mm-hmm. Here is my design. Now, while I took you from Adam's side, not from his head to rule over, not from his foot to be rule over, side to be co-equal, okay, as in my original design. Now that you were the one deceived and brought your husband in, now I have a new plan. He's going to rule over you and you're going to submit to his authority. Is God describing his new plan? This is what I want to happen. This is the best for you. Do it this way. This is how it's often taught.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see it that way at all. I see God describing, because of what you've done, here's how it's going to be. Mm-hmm. You can't tell just from it. You have to actually read it. He describes, your desire will be for your husband, and he will rule over you. That's all it says. Is that I'm making your desire. I'm going to work a miracle, and I'm going to put this in your heart, and I'm going to change him so he's going to do it. No. What is the natural result of fear and selfishness in the heart? The natural result of fear and selfishness is insecurity. The weak have a desire to be protected and made safe by the strong.
Mm-hmm.
And the strong seek to dominate and control the weak. Now that you are both infected with fear and selfishness, ladies, in a world through human history without a civilization, when it was, you think about the tribal situations and you look at human history, women were constantly seeking strong men to take care of them and make them feel safe. And men were constantly dominating and ruling over the women.
Mm-hmm.
It's not God's design. It's the natural result of what sin does. God's just describing, it's what's going to happen now.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you come to Christ and give your heart to Christ, Ephesians, then the husbands, rather than dominating and controlling their wife, begin to treat the wife like Christ treats the church, sacrificing himself to build her up. The whole dynamic changes, but only when the heart's given to Christ.
That's right.
But this is important because, you know, most Christians that I know don't see it this way. What do you think?
No, I agree with you on that. And actually, piggybacking off of what James shared earlier, in the church, in the culture, we're taught to not express anger. How do we express this anger in a way that's, you can check in with yourself and make sure that it's not ego-driven?
So I think the first, I like what you said. When you get angry, to step back and reflect, what am I angry about? Is it because my ego is? Is it a selfish anger? Mm-hmm. Is it a righteous anger? Is it an anger because I love somebody and I see what they're doing is harming themselves and they're refusing treatment? Is it an anger because what I want for me is being interfered with? You know, as I think about the things that actually cause me irritation and anger, it's usually when I perceive somebody trying to put on me something that's not mine, blaming me for something I didn't do, making me responsible for stuff that's not mine.
Yeah.
Not blame, but put a burden on me that's not mine.
Right.
Making me responsible for, Dr. Jennings, you said this the other day in the meeting, and so-and-so, I got their feelings hurt. You need to go and apologize to that person.
Right.
Okay, wait a second. Let me reflect. Mm-hmm. What did I say?
Mm-hmm.
Did I say something that was actually wrong?
Mm-hmm.
Poorly stated, so it was easily miscommunicated, I could clear up.
Mm-hmm.
Or do I say something quite clear and reasonable? Is it a situation like the apostles to Jesus, don't you know you offended them?
Mm-hmm.
Go apologize to them. Mm-hmm. Versus, you know, I actually did something. If I did something wrong, I don't get angry. I go, thank you, and I make it right. But what makes me angry is when a situation like that is, I'm supposed to take responsibility for someone else's
emotions,
and in my view, wrong. They're wrong because they're responding
by interpreting things in a way that make it offensive when there's no offense intended or stated even. Nobody else in the room had their feelings hurt.
Mm-hmm.
This one person did. This is an interpretation. And then I take some irritation at whomever might come to me advocating in their behalf, and you know, triangulation and so forth.
Yeah.
Okay. That's putting that pressure on me is like, I get a little bit irritated. Is that righteous or unrighteous anger? What do you think?
Well, if it was not yours and it's been put on you, I could say that is righteous, because it was not right for them to blame you for something that's not your fault.
I think it is too, and I try to handle it in not always have, I will tell you,
mm-hmm.
not always have, but try to handle it in reasonable ways and try to, you know, reflect it back. I really don't have that with my patients at all. For some reason, with my patients, who will constantly do kind of stuff like that,
yeah.
I'm in a different mental state. I'm in a different mode. I'm processing and understanding my patient. I'm very accepting and gracious, and I really don't get that kind of defensiveness or anger. But I guess with colleagues or peers, I'm expecting better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's a pretty important differentiation. I'm glad you brought that up, because, you know, just because we can experience, we have the capacity. I mean, obviously, in the beginning when God made Adam and Eve, the right relationship with God was there. That selfishness would not have been there. So their capacity for emotion would have been in the right direction. It would have been selfless rather than being corrupted, like you guys are mentioning. So that's a vital thing. I love how you said that when we feel the feeling, especially anger, stepping back and saying, okay, why? And what's the motivation?
So let's close out with something to tell our listening audience, if they've struggled with concerns about God's anger, mm-hmm. what can we say that would help them maybe, you know, reflect on and reprocess that so they don't have to be afraid of God?
Mm. Well, you know, one of the things that I've learned and tried to help people learn is whenever we encounter a belief or a passage or something like that that conflicts with both God's character or with reality or both, we need to go back and reexamine our interpretation. And so if the interpretation of the passage is God is angry and vengeful, so he destroys all these people, that doesn't line up with God's character of love. Yeah, you know, when we talk about,
yeah, but he's also just.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah,
but they'll say, yes, he's love, but you're discounting his justice and justice. I just actually had a pastor email me this week about this. Yes, God is love, but what Satan tries to do is separate God's love from his justice. And mm-hmm. I hear you doing that. Yes, of course he's love, but at some point when people are in persistent rebellion and doing wickedly, doesn't justice require God to use his power to put it down? This is the argument a pastor sent me.
Well, and we'd have to go back and re-examine what we mean by justice. Mm-hmm. Is God's justice the same as man's justice?
Mm-hmm.
And that would be
I agree with you.
Yeah, yeah. But that's an important distinction to make. So when we once again encounter something that's out of alignment with God's character or reality, we have to shift our belief. And so as a guy that was taught very much to be terrified of God because of his wrath, that was a misunderstanding. And so if a person has that, I would encourage them to go back and reexamine that in light of truth.
Well, I want to support what you just mm-hmm. said by giving them a touchstone.
Yeah.
Everything you just said, reexamine in light of truth by looking at Jesus.
Yes. Yes.
Who is God in human flesh.
Yeah, he is the truth.
If you've seen me, you've seen the Father.
That's
right.
Father
and I am one. So if you have questions about Old Testament God and you think that it's go to Jesus, that's the touchstone.
Mm-hmm.
And if it doesn't line up with the life of Jesus, then you're misunderstanding the Old Testament.
Yes.
If you think that Jesus spoke gently on the Mount of Olivet, he cried over Jerusalem, I would take you as a hen takes her chin, but you wouldn't let me. You see God thundering at Sinai. If you don't see the same God there, you need to reprocess what you're seeing.
Mm-hmm.
You need to reprocess, think through, because the God at Sinai was Jesus.
Which is why.
If you question me on that, read 1 Corinthians
mm-hmm.
chapter 10,
yeah.
where Paul says that the rock that Israel drank from in the desert was Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
That is the God that led them and thundered and all that stuff was Jesus doing that. And so I think the touchstone to understand God's character is everything you see in the life of Jesus. That is the clearest revelation. And the Old Testament must be interpreted mm-hmm. through what Jesus revealed about how God functions. Is that fair?
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you for joining us today. I hope this was helpful to you. If you have questions, send those in to questions@designformore.net, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you for joining us on Designed for More, brought to you by Come and Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. Also, don't forget to check out our other podcasts for more inspiring content.